I've just been making an announcement with my microphone muted. Sorry about that. Just wanted to welcome everybody to Venerable George's teachings tonight for the weekend workshop on transforming problems into happiness. Venerable George will be with us in a moment. He's teaching tonight from 7 to 9 and tomorrow and Sunday afternoons from 1 to 4. And then next week, he's teaching again the Discovering Buddhism on Monday night. And then a weekend workshop again next weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday on the Heart Sutra. So they all promise to be very wonderful teachings. I'm looking forward to them. And Venerable George has joined us.
Howdy. So you said they promise to be good, but they might not be good. Something like that.
Well, value judgment on my part.
That's probably right. So good evening. I'll wait a couple seconds and let Sister Donna do some preliminary things she wanted to do.
Yes, Venerable George, we would like to start with offering you a mandala to request the teachings.
Oh, look at that.
We have Laura here to offer. Saji Puki Chukshing Meto Tramri Ravling Ji Nide Genpadi Sangye Jindu Mikte Uwa Yidro Kunam Dag Jing La Chirpa Shok Jetsun Lama Dampa Kenam Kichu Kukala Kense Chutin Tree Jitar Tsampe Dulje Tsingma La Jab Ge Chu Ki Cha Wa Gu So Iram Guru Namanda Kamiya Chayami.
Wow, that's nice. Thank you.
Thank you. That was good.
Good. Okay. So I see some familiar names here. Even Diana Bravo's on here. That's interesting. Good. So, and Joanna and her partner. Hi, guys.
Patrick.
I probably know a lot of you. And Adriana. Hi. Who sent me a photo of flowers. So that was nice. And Elise and Venerable Kundro and David and yeah. I don't know if I know. I probably would know some of the rest. And Laura, yeah, who offered the mandala. And Sandra, okay. So, nice to be with you. I'm not sure if more people will come as the minutes progress, but maybe we can start. So, the Kadampa Center requested me to teach the 8 verses of Training the Mind, which is a text that perhaps many of you have already received teachings on, maybe many times. And Sister Donna told me that it was one of her favorite, or her most favorite texts, one of the first ones she received. It's quite fitting because it was composed on the subject matter of the training of the mind that was exemplified by Atisha and his followers, who were called the Kadampa Geshis. You know that, right? Kadampa Center is named after that tradition of pure practitioners who existed, you know, sometime before Lama Tsongkhapa, around the time of Atisha. And Atisha, his main disciple, Drondempa, who was an emanation of Avalokiteshvara, and it's considered that the Dalai Lamas consider themselves, the present Dalai Lamas consider themselves to be the reincarnations of Drondempa. So the first Dalai Lama is kind of considered to be, the Dalai Lamas are considered to be emanations of Thousand Arm Avalokiteshvara, and Drondempa was said to be an emanation of Avalokiteshvara. So they believe that they are emanations of Drondempa in that great Kadampa tradition. So the way that this text came about that we're going to be studying is that, of course, Atisha spent a lot of time, a lot of effort in his lifetime developing bodhicitta. It was one of the major objects of enthusiastic perseverance. Of course, he was a great scholar in all of the different fields, but he had, it's said that he had three main gurus with whom he studied bodhicitta. One of them was the author of a text that some of you may have received teachings on or read the book. It's called The Wheel of Sharp Weapons. And not so long ago, there was a very nice commentary by it, composed by one of my teachers, Geshe Sopa, Lundup Sopa, called The Peacock in the Poison Garden, I think something like that. That was composed by an Indian guru called Dharma Rakshita. And Dharma Rakshita was resident at one of the great monasteries of India, and Atisha studied bodhicitta with him. Another one of his teachers was an Indian also called Maitri Yogi. And sometimes when you receive teachings, when you see the collection of empowerments that Lama Zopa sometimes gives the Rinchen Gyatso, you know, hundreds of different empowerments, many of them are attributed to Maitri Yogi. Sometimes it's called Maitri Yogi. I'm not sure why. You know, the G is in Yogi, kind of with the J, Maitri Yogi. He was also called Kusali the Younger. And Lama Atisha also studied with him. But his most important guru to develop bodhicitta was who was called Sudharma Dipa, or in Tibetan, Serlingpa. Suvarna in Sanskrit means golden, right? Like ser in Serlingpa. And Dvipa means, Lingpa means island. So they got Golden Island, the Lama of the Golden Island, who was also called ordination named Dharmakirti, like the great logician. So the difference, Dharma Rakshita, who wrote The Wheel of Sharp Weapons, but Dharmakirti or Serlingpa, Sudharma Dipa, he was the Lama, the guru, Indian guru, with whom Lama Atisha studied for something like 12 years. He had a perilous journey to Indonesia in a boat, where it was attacked, you know, the boat was attacked by storms, experienced storms, and maybe sea monsters, who knows what they were, whales or dragons or something like that. And it took something like 13 months to get there. And when he got there, he made extensive offerings to Sudharmadipa or Sirlingpa. And he was accepted as a disciple, and he was, the guru asked him, asked Atisha, was he willing to stay for, if he wanted to receive all the teachings on a bodhicitta, would he stay for 12 years? And Atisha said yes. So he received those teachings, and many of the teachings that he received were sort of like integrated into his presentation of the training of the mind later, this genre of literature that Atisha eventually brought to Tibet at the invitation of some Tibetan kings. You know the story probably of Atisha coming from the Lanrim teachings and everything. So of those, you know, of the teachings that he gave, he wrote a text called The Jewel Ornament of Bodhisattvas, which is still available in translation. I think you can find that. That was kind of like a prototype. And there were some other lamas who wrote some, from his oral teachings that Atisha gave to Drondempa, and Drondempa himself passed on to his disciples. Some texts were written eventually. At first, the teachings were just transmitted orally. They weren't written down. And eventually, when they were written down, there were a couple of texts. To give you an idea of the people, you may know in the Lanrim lineage, and I mentioned this when I taught this at Guhya Samaja Center. I'm going to move the camera a little bit. So you see the tanka behind me, right? The Lanrim lineage gurus and everything. So up here on either side, above Lama Tsongkhapa on the two sides, are the lineages of method and wisdom. And both of them go down from Indian guru, from the, you know, the Buddha Shakyamuni himself to the wisdom lineage to Manjushri, and the method lineage to Maitreya. And then there are Indian gurus of those two lineages up there first. And then the second group of lamas just below that, you may have tankas of your own, are the Kadampa Geshes, starting with Atisha. And there are three, they're generally in the Gelugpa tradition, we talk about these three kinds of lineages of the Kadampas. We talk about the Shungbawa. Shung is a Tibetan word that means treatise, you know, vast corpus. So the Shungbawas were the ones of the Kadampas who studied Atisha's teachings, mainly Atisha's teachings being the Lam Drone, the lamp of the path, which is the name of the course that Lama Zopa has been teaching some for many years. Hopefully we'll be teaching again next year. And they studied it by way of studying the six great texts of the Kadampas. Do you know that? How many people know those six texts? William's nodding his head. No? Oh, I thought he was. Oh. So it's kind of interesting because in Sarah J and in the Gelugpa monasteries now, we usually study five great treatises, but they're not the same as the six treatises of the Kadampa. So you might make note of this. I thought I had it written down here, but I think I can remember. So the six treatises were the Bodhisattva Bhumi, which is a text comprised by Maitreya, transmitted to a Sangha, part of what's called the Yogacara Bhumi, the Bodhisattva Bhumi.
which tells all of the details of the bodhisattvas. So that was one of their main things. Another was another text by Maitreya transmitted to a sangha called the Mahayana Sutra Alamkara. Have you heard of that? Mahayana Sutra Alamkara. Many years ago, Kirti Senchab Rinpoche taught that text to us with Lama Zopa translating in Bodh Gaya. Was one of the first times. So that also fills in many of those details. Then two texts by Shantideva. One is the Siksha Samuchaya, which you may or may not have heard of. It's called the Compendium of Trainings, which was a text that Shantideva comprised. I think he comprised, he might have written it before the Bodhisattva Charyavatara, which is the fourth text. Maybe I should say Bodhisattva Charyavatara first. So the two texts by Maitreya and Asanga, the Bodhisattva Bhumi and the Mahayana Sutra Alamkara, then the Bodhisattva Charyavatara by Shantideva. At the end of that text, it said, Shantideva meditated on emptiness and rose in the sky and disappeared. And the monks were trying to find him for a long time to ask questions about the text that he had been teaching, right? You know this story? And when they finally found him, he gave them this other text, the Siksha Samuchaya, which is essentially a compilation or compendium of many different quotations from the Mahayana Sutras that verified his teachings in the Bodhisattva Charyavatara. So they studied those two texts also by Shantideva. And then they studied the Jatakamala, the rosary of life stories of the Bodhisattva before he became Buddha Shakyamuni, which I've was very, very inspired when I did a three-year retreat. Every day when I did the Guru Puja, when you get to the seven limb puja, one of the seven limbs is rejoicing. So I would always read one of those Jataka tales, the incredibly inspiring and rejoicing in the activities of the Buddha. And then the sixth text was the Udarana Varga, which is what sometimes is called, I think Gerasparam translated it, and he called it the Mahayana Dharmapada. Have you heard of the Dharmapada? One of the famous Theravada texts that took short sayings from the Buddha's teachings and put them in various categories. And there was also that's generally drawn from the Theravada sutras. And the Mahayana version of that were drawn from the Mahayana sutras. Many, many of the verses exactly the same, some a little bit different. And they would study that also. So it was like very tasty, these six texts that they studied. So of the three Kadampa lineages, the ones that were called the Shumbhava, the ones who were those who studied the great treatises, studied those six treatises, and of course other things, Prajnaparamita and other things, and Atisha's teachings. Then there were the Lamrimpas, who mainly studied Atisha's Lamdrun. They didn't study all of the detailed Indian treatises, but they studied the very detailed explanation of the stages to the path to enlightenment. You've heard of that before, right? The Lamrimpas. Lamrim means the stages of the path. And then there were the ones that were called the Mengakpas. Those who, Mengak is a word that means pith instruction, something that you receive from the guru. So those were they might be in a sense people who, the ones who studied the great treatises were the ones that either were more intelligent or might not have been more intelligent. They just liked things extensive. And the Lanrimpas were the ones who were sort of middling, perhaps, in intelligence, or they could have been very intelligent, but they liked things, they didn't like to study all of those details. They liked to have things put into practice. And those who were the lineage of the pith instructions, the Mengakpas, they were the ones that might have been satisfied with just receiving teachings from their own guru, and maybe that teacher would ask them to study the Lan Rim or some of these other texts occasionally, but their main emphasis was receiving instruction from their teacher and putting that into practice. So of those, the main teacher of the great treatises, after Atisha, who passed his lineage on to Drondempa, one of the heart disciples of Drondempa was called Geshe Potowa. You might have heard of Geshe Potowa. Very, very great, in all the aspects. And he and another disciple are called the sun and the moon. The other disciple was called Langritampa, who was the author of the text we're going to be studying. So Langritampa received teachings on the training of the mind lineage from Atisha and Drondempa. He and Potowa were the main two disciples of Drondempa. And they helped to perpetuate the Kadampa tradition. So Langritampa wrote out this very short training of the mind tech, essentially just eight verses. In Tibetan, there are four lines in each verse, so 32 lines, kind of giving an introduction that could be introduced to the public, because up until that time, there had been some other teachings on the training of the mind, the Lojong, that had been written, but they may not have been distributed or taught in public so much. So Langritampa's text, The Eight Verses of Training of the Mind, was one of the first. And we have commentary on that. Langritampa didn't write a commentary on his verses himself, or if he did, it didn't survive as far as we know. We don't have any text of it. But one of the first lamas who wrote a commentary on it was the lama who eventually wrote the 7-point training of the mind. Now, some of you know that text, right? That's more extensive Lojong or teaching of the mind training. So that Geshe was named, also Kadampa Geshe was called Geshe Chekawa. So Geshe Chekawa, before he wrote the 7-point training of the mind, he was very inspired by having teachings on the 8 verses. He received from one of his gurus teachings on the 8 verses. And he wanted to study with Langritampa to find, to understand the meaning of those verses. But Langritampa had already passed away at that time. So he went to see one of the lamas who had studied with Langritampa and had received all of the lineage. And he came with the intention of asking him some questions, especially about one of the verses that talks about accepting the defeat and giving the victory to others. Do you know that verse? You know the one I'm talking about? When others out of envy or jealousy abuse or insult me, I'll accept the defeat and offer the victory to others, something like that. So he thought, wow, this is... Yeah. Many of the verses he had found very, very helpful as he traveled through Tibet, and he wanted to ask some questions of this disciple of Langritampa. He came to an assembly, and the Lama was teaching the Shravaka Bhumi. Remember I told you that one of the six texts of the Kadampas was called the Bodhisattva Bhumi. Not the Bodhisattva, one of the texts on the Bodhisattva practices by us that Maitreya had composed and given to a Sangha. And the Bodhisattva Bhumi, the stages of the Bodhisattvas. And there's another text called the Shravaka Bhumi, which means the stages of the Shravakas, the hearers. So this, the teacher that Langri Tampa went to try to investigate Langri Tampa's teachings was teaching the Shravaka Bhumi, which is all talking about the Hinayana practices. Never mentioned anything about bodhicitta. And afterwards, he waited around to ask some questions. Finally was able to find the Lama when he was, I think he was circumambulating a stupa or something, put down his zen, you know, the shawl on the ground, and asked the Lama to sit down. And the Lama was kind of curt and said, you don't have to ask any questions. I taught everything in the lecture hall, you know, don't bother me. And he said, no, but I have some questions about the bodhicitta, which you didn't talk about. So finally the Lama sat down and he asked him some questions, and he asked was there a scriptural verification, you know, some kind of scriptural source for that verse about accepting the defeat and giving the victory to others? And the Lama told him, indeed, you can find in the teachings of Nagarjuna. I think it's in the Precious Garland, I'm not sure, one of Nagarjuna's texts. And so he was very, very inspired by that, Geshe Chekhawa. And so he, in receiving teachings from that Lama on Langri Tampa's 8 verses, he composed a commentary, which is still available in the Tibetan. I think if you have access to different texts, you can find it in different texts, but this one by Thupten Jinpa. Can you read that? Oh, it's backwards on my screen. Is it forward? Can you read it in your screen?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Mine is reversed. So Essential Mind Training by Thupten Jinpa. So in there, he has his own translation of that text by Chekhova and the root verses of the 8 verses. You can also find it in the big gray text that Wisdom has put out called the Lojong Chembo, I think, in Tibetan. It means a big compendium of Lojong teachings, many, many Lojong teachings. And there is the 8 verses and Chekhova's commentary on it. So that's kind of a little bit of background. With that, since more people have shown up, let's do a little meditation to begin with, to try to set a good motivation for listening to these teachings. So relax your body. I'm going to take a sip of water here. Relax your body. Sit straight, your spine erect, eyes partially open, looking down the side of your nose. Relax your mind. Remind yourself that you don't have to think of anything else right now. And begin by just watching your respiration without controlling it. In fine detail, recognize when you're breathing in, when it changes direction, when you breathe out, when it changes direction again, you breathe in. Let every other thought go unattended to your mental consciousness. Just watch the breathing.
you have a little success with that, calming your mind, bring your attention away from, take your attention away from the breathing. You'll still breathe, of course, and place your attention, your mindfulness on the mental consciousness itself, that within which you're thinking, making plans, remembering, mentally making comments about what's happening to you, noting the pain in your body or whatever, thinking. And just watch the activity of your mind for a while. Again, it's not a matter of trying to dredge up some thoughts that will be coming to your mind anyway. There might be images, different thoughts or appearances may occur to your mind due to karma ripening, due to just the sequence of events that have been taken, that you've taken part in today. When the mind is a little bit quiet, try to focus on that almost space-like sensation of the mind. Not occupied, you know, sort of devoid of thoughts. Try to hold that, elongate that until another thought comes. If thoughts are coming nonstop, you can remind yourself that there's no way for them to be occurring in your mind unless your mind had this nature of being spacious and clear, what the Buddha called the clear light nature of the mind, the conventional clear light nature of the mind. So even if a thought is present, something that's been bothering you, recognize that there's no way that that could be occurring in your mind unless your mind had the space for it, the thought to occur in. Just recognizing that, let the thought itself get out of focus, refocus your attention on the spaciousness of the mind that allows that thought to arise. You have to be alert, even more alert than you were in watching the breathing. Try to get a sense of that spaciousness. This nature of our mind, within which all of the thoughts and mental activities take place in, this clear light nature of the mind, is what His Holiness the Dalai Lama said we could call the conventional Buddha nature. Our Buddha nature. It's that within which we can develop all the good qualities and sort of the laboratory within which we can learn to get rid of all the faulty states of mind. And within that calm clarity, recalling that we have a life as a human being right now of what the Buddha called leisure and richness, leisure and endowment, or freedom and endowment. We're free from states within cyclic existence when we have no leisure or freedom to practice the Dharma, being born in hell or as an animal or other states like that. And we have, through the creation of karma in previous lives, everything we really need to practice the Dharma. You don't need to have a Mercedes-Benz to practice Dharma, although some of you may have a Mercedes-Benz. We have a human life with faculties that are able to hear and see, read, and so forth. We have faith in the Dharma. The Buddha descended into our world system, has turned the wheel of Dharma, and those teachings still have not degenerated. We can still receive the blessings of them. We have some faith in that. We have a spiritual community with whom to find some support in the practice. And we even have sometimes benefactors of the center and of our own practice. So to try to utilize this life of leisure and endowment this evening for the greatest purpose, think, I'm going to participate in the teaching tonight, talk tonight, and this weekend, not simply to accumulate knowledge or find a way to solve some temporary problem, although those goals can be found along the way, but with a very profound, deep goal of elevating ourself, healing ourself, becoming a real person. A mensch is said in Yiddish, a real, a bodhisattva. And with the aim of eventually achieving enlightenment out of compassion for sentient beings, from that state being able to effortlessly and spontaneously lead sentient beings, whatever time it takes, out of suffering of samsara into enlightenment. So try to set a motivation thinking, I'm going to participate this evening in order to achieve enlightenment eventually for the sake of all living beings. That's my main goal. And myself as a speaker, I try to have a similar motivation like that, but also speaking, not just listening, but speaking for that purpose, to try to accumulate the qualities to achieve enlightenment eventually, to benefit sentient beings now and help them orient toward that goal. So then relax a little bit, bring your attention back to the present. How are you doing? I see some faces. I see some legs. Some people, there's a face. Okay, I see a ceiling. Julie Lewis must be gone. Okay. What am I missing? Adriana. Okay. So as we're going through this tonight and tomorrow, if you have questions, maybe we've got enough time. You can either raise your hand if you're on the screen that I can see. I can't see everyone at the same time. Or you could send a little message to Donna, and occasionally I can stop and, you know, try to answer some questions. But hopefully there'll be time at the end of the of tonight's talk to specialize in questions. But if you have something that's pressing, you know, you, what did he say? I didn't catch that, you know, ask. Okay, so I'm going to be using as a basis the FPMT translation. Is that the one you usually use, Donna, at the center? It's a PDF file that if you don't have, you can download from, oh, you have, some people have. You can download from FPMT. This is translated by Lama Zopa Rinpoche. I will give some alternative translations of the lines, because if you studied it at all, you may find that different translators translated in different ways. One text you might find interesting if you don't already have it is, I'll try to get it all in there, 8 Verses Training the Mind by Geshe Sonam Rinchen, translated and edited by Ruth Sonam from Snow Lion. That's very excellent. So this commentary by Geshe Sonam Rinchen, some of you may have studied with him. And then there's Thupten Jinpa's translation in this text that I showed you originally. There are many other texts. One that I particularly like is one that I'm not sure if it's still available. It used to be given out in Los Angeles when the Dalai Lama taught, by Geshe Sultan Gelsen, who's passed away since then. He was one of the great disciples of Song Rinpoche, and he would always come, like the present teacher from New York City. What's his name? The Lama of Tibet House. You know what I mean? Donna, do you know who I'm talking about? They were monks earlier, and they gave up their ordination when they came to the West, but started Buddhist centers. So Sultan Gelsen's commentary in this book, Keys to Great Enlightenment, there's a commentary on the 37 practices of the Buddhist sons, of the Jinaputra, the conqueror's sons, and his translation and commentary on the 8 verses, which is quite nice in that text. So if you want to go into more detail, you can find that, or you can search on the web. In the Wisdom Archives, Lama Yeshe gave commentary. I think Lama Zopa gave commentary. You can probably find commentaries by the Dalai Lama on YouTube. Sometimes, when His Holiness teaches, if he teaches other subjects, he often will teach the 8 verses of Training the Mind, because it's brief enough to give an oral transmission of and a little bit of an understanding of in a short time, rather than teaching the Bodhisattvacharya Avatara, which is much, much more lengthy and so forth, okay? So, begin by reading the verses, first of all, the 8 verses of thought transformation. The Tibetans say, Lojong Sik Gema. Can mean a word, but also can mean kind of verses. Gema means 8. Lojong means training of the mind. Determined to obtain the greatest possible benefit from all sentient beings, who are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel,
I hold them most dear at all times. This is Lama Zopa's translation. That's the first verse. Second verse, wherever I am and whoever I am with, should that be whomever I am with? I always consider myself the lowest of all, and from the depths of my heart hold others dear and supreme. That's the second verse. And we'll talk about these in order. Third verse, in all actions, I examine my mental continuum, and the minute a delusion arises, or you can say a moment, the moment a delusion arises, since it endangers myself and others, I forcefully confront and avert it. Fourth verse, whenever I see sentient beings who are wicked in nature and overwhelmed by negative actions and heavy suffering, I hold such rare ones dear as if I had found a precious treasure. Okay. That's the fourth verse. Fifth verse, when out of envy, others mistreat me with abuse, insults, or the like, I accept defeat and offer the victory to them. That's the verse I referred to before, that Geshe Tsekho was sort of, wow, this is it. Accept the defeat, give the victory to others. How can you do that? And then the sixth verse, when someone whom I have benefited and in whom I have great hope gives me terrible harm, I regard them as my virtuous friend. That means you're almost like your guru. And seventh verse, in short, both directly and indirectly, I offer every happiness and benefit to all my mothers. I secretly take upon myself all their harms and sufferings. That's the seventh verse. And then the culmination, the eighth verse, also, I do not defile all these practices. Maybe you could say any of these practices. Also, I do not defile all these practices by the stains of the superstitions of the eight worldly concerns, and by knowing all phenomena to be illusory, without trusting them, I am freed from bondage. So Rinpoche, the colophon says, this rendition of Kadampa Geshe Langri Tangpa's eight verses of thought transformation was translated by Lama Sopa Rinpoche in a text called The Ever-Flowing Nectar of Bodhicitta that was published by FPMT in 2008. And he's made some adjustments of some of the other verses you can read in the colophon there. So that's sort of the basis of what we're going to be talking about. So just to give a little overview, another overview, when we talk about training of the mind, basically what it means is that we're trying to develop what are called the two types of enlightened mind, or bodhicittas. You've heard of the word bodhicitta, right? Has anyone not heard of bodhicitta? I can't see everyone's face. Has anyone not heard of bodhicitta? Most everyone I can see. So generally when we talk about bodhicitta, we think of what's called conventional bodhicitta. That means developing a particular primary mental consciousness. So it's a little bit sort of surprising. You might think it's some kind of thought process. It's a a state of mind that you develop in your mental consciousness, in your primary mental consciousness, which has been nurtured by great compassion for sentient beings, feeling their suffering, feeling an allegiance and an affection for them, wanting them to be free of that suffering, and having analyzed and recognized the only way that you can really lead everyone out of their suffering and into happiness is for you yourself to become enlightened, to become a Buddha. Of course, you can become a doctor, you can become a teacher, you can become the SPC at a Kadampa Center. you can be a doctor or, you know, whatever, and help sentient beings immensely with bodhicitta motivation. But any kind of thing that you do for sentient beings will be somewhat limited by your realization, you know, where you can orient in them. You may be able to give them advice for this lifetime or even give them advice about the Dharma, but unless you understand and have realized the state of enlightenment, you can't really lead sentient beings skillfully out of their suffering over whatever number of lives it takes. That's called conventional bodhicitta. So it's a primary mental consciousness, conventional bodhicitta, primary mental consciousness that sort of acts as a doorway to the Mahayana. If you have conventional bodhicitta, you have entered into the Mahayana path. You have become a bodhisattva. So bodhicitta means the mind of enlightenment. Citta means mind. Bodhisattva, again, bodhi means enlightenment. Sattva means can mean sentient being, but it also can mean courageous being. So a courageous being who's aiming for bodhi for the sake of sentient beings. That word will come up again in next weekend's seminar on the Heart Sutra, because it says any bodhisattva or mahasattva, you know, yeah, the Avalokiteshvara, the great bodhisattva, mahasattva. So we'll talk about that next week also. So that's called conventional bodhicitta. The other bodhicittas was called ultimate bodhicitta. Ultimate bodhicitta means once one has become a bodhisattva, you have conventional bodhicitta, aiming for enlightenment for the sake of others. Ultimate bodhicitta is within your mind stream, the wisdom that realizes emptiness. That is called ultimate bodhicitta. Ultimate bodhicitta is not a name that's given to the wisdom of emptiness of the Hinayana practitioners, the hearers or solitary realizers, because they don't have bodhicitta, conventional bodhicitta, in their mind stream. They have a very special mind of renunciation, wishing definitely to get out of cyclic existence for themselves, for their own welfare. So their realization of emptiness is not called ultimate bodhicitta. It's only the realization of emptiness within the mind stream of a person who's developed conventional bodhicitta that's called, that realization of emptiness is called ultimate bodhicitta. Okay? So, say conventional bodhicitta, so the method side, ultimate bodhicitta, the wisdom side. Those are the two main aims of training the mind. So here the first seven verses of the eight verses are mainly talking about working to develop bodhicitta and the various methods that are used dealing with particular problematic situations, how to really put that into practice. And the eighth verse is talking about ultimate bodhicitta, although, you know, kind of inferred also by the first verses, but the eighth verse is the one that's talking about ultimate bodhicitta. So, first verse here. determined to obtain the greatest possible benefit from all sentient beings, is how Lama Zopa Rinpoche has, who are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel, I hold them most dear at all times. So let me give an alternative translation of this, because all of the Tibetan texts have the first line. It doesn't say from all sentient beings. It actually says, and Tibetan says, Dagi Semchen Tamche La, which means for all sentient beings. Although there may be some texts that have the ablative, you know, the, what do you call it, you know, particle for all sentient beings. This is, I'd say, yeah, this is, instead of saying from all sentient beings, the text actually says for all sentient beings. So an alternative way of understanding this is with a responsibility. Here Lama Zopa says determined, or you could say the word sampa here in the Tibetan text, you know, thinking, you could say thinking to obtain the highest benefit for sentient beings. And Lama Zopa Rinpoche's translation says, who are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel? So the actual text is ambiguous here. It we'll see from the commentary in a second, almost looks like it's referring to sentient beings. Sentient beings who are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel. Some people take it as determined to get the greatest benefit, which is more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel, meaning to get the greatest benefit, meaning enlightenment. I will hold them most dear at all times. Okay, so let's get into this. So one of the precepts of developing conventional bodhicitta in the training of the mind teachings are the precepts of recognizing that our mind now is dominated by what's called self-cherishing thought, right? The thought that takes one's own welfare as paramount. Even if you talk about heroes in the army or, you know, in the world and so forth, generally people are working for their own benefits, or for their own nation, or for their own family, or for their, you know, their favored group. Self-cherishing thought. In order to develop bodhicitta, you have to overcome that tendency to put one's own welfare and happiness as paramount. So instead of cherishing yourself and your own welfare, we have to learn to cherish others. That's the sort of the key ingredient in these mind training teachings. These mind training teachings are especially coming in the lineage of what's called equalizing and exchanging self and others. Have you heard that before? Equalizing and exchanging self and others. So right now we cherish ourselves and kind of ignore the welfare of the others to a certain degree, maybe, you know, not completely. You might say, I'm not such a bad person. I take care of others. But when you get down to the nitty gritty, we're mainly cherishing ourselves. The first step in overcoming that is to equalize the importance of others' welfare and your own. If there's one piece of cheesecake left on the table, in the kitchen table, instead of waiting till the other person is turned around and taking it for yourself, to cut it in half, give half to them, equalizing, you know, their welfare and your welfare. Whereas exchanging yourself and others, what that means is not it doesn't mean you become the other. What it means is that you exchange your attitude of who you're working for. Rather than working for your own welfare, working for the welfare of others, cherishing others. So exchanging self and others, you'd give the whole piece of cheesecake. Is that a good example in Raleigh? Cheesecake, I'm not sure. In Italy, it might be pizza or gelato or something like that. So this is saying, I will hold them most dear at all times. Another, this word, hold them most dear, in Lama Zopa Rinpoche's translation.
Venerable George?
Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, it's good. Good.
Hold on, I'm going to close the door. What, can you repeat that part of what it meant to exchange yourself with others?
Right.
I got something. So I just want to have a very clear understanding of what you meant by that.
Right. So exchanging self and others doesn't mean that you become the other person, that your mind inhabits them or something like that. What it means is that your attitude of who you're working for changes. So instead of working for yourself and ignoring the other, you work for the welfare of the other. You cherish them or hold them dear. So that's what I was just about to say in here. The Tibetan word chepar zimba means to hold dear. That's how Rinpoche is doing. Usually that's a word that we call cherish. If you cherish something, you know, your Ming vase or your iPad or something like that, you hold it as very dear. Generally, we hold ourselves as dear, and we don't hold others as dear. If we hold others or we cherish others, it's because generally they benefit us in some way. You know, they love us or they give us some, some pleasure or something like that, which is not real meaning of cherishing. So exchanging self and others means exchanging your attitude that predominantly is working for your own welfare, holding yourself as dear, actually recognizing that our attitude of working for our own benefit has many shortcomings. It's what it called in the teachings of the training of the mind is called the faults of self-cherishing. So if you cherish yourself most dear, that predisposes you to create negative karma. If someone abuses you or steals from you or hurts you in some way, you can get angry. If you don't get what you want, attachment rises, maybe jealousy rises, so forth. All of the delusions are sort of the cooperative condition that causes all of the delusions to easily arise is a self-cherishing thought.
Okay.
So remember, you've all heard of what's called self-grasping, right? When we talk about emptiness. Donna, do you know what self-grasping is? You've got your speaker off, huh? You know what I'm saying? You can nod if you want. Yeah, okay, you know what self-grasping is. So self-grasping is the fundamental ignorance that perceives a self-identity. And as a result of that, you know, the delusions can rise. But what causes them to arise more quickly is, as a result of self-grasping, believing in a self-identity that doesn't really exist, like an inherently existent I, a self, As a result of that, and through familiarity with that mind over numberless lifetimes in the past, we tend to take care of this imagined self. That second mind, this attitude of self-cherishing, is the one that we're dealing with here. First of all, it's not talking about eliminating the ignorance that grasps to a self of persons. Now, some of you, this may be new material. Some of you, you've heard this so many times over the years. You might wonder why I'm mentioning it again, but to deal with the whatever number of people there are, 31 people or something here. So I'm one of them. So there's 30 of you. I have to explain some of these things again. So when we talk about I will hold them most dear at all times, you could say I will cherish them. I will always cherish them. Taktu means always. Chepa zimpa means cherish or hold dear. This Tibetan verse actually ends with the word lap, that means I will train to do that. Lama Zopa is translated in a way that he prefers. It just says I will hold them. The verse actually says I will hold. I will train to cherish all sentient beings who excel the wish-fulfilling jewel with a thought to achieve their highest welfare. That's kind of what it's saying. So what does that mean? You know what a wish-fulfilling jewel is? Have you heard of that before? Anyone who doesn't say? No. You don't know? So wish-fulfilling jewel is kind of like the Indian equivalent of an Aladdin's lamp. You get a certain number of wishes. You rub the lamp, you clean it in some way, and then you get one, two, three wishes or something like that, right? In Indian mythology, and Buddhism believes not just a myth, that there exists a kind of stone that is generally only very, very rare, first of all, and sometimes is something that the universal monarchs have possession of. You've heard of the Chakravartin kings, very special people who've created incredible karma in the past. Like when we offer the mandala, the long version says, I offer the precious wheel and the precious jewel and the precious queen and the precious minister and so forth, amongst these other things, the four continents and so forth. So the precious jewel is something that Chakravartins have, bodhisattvas have access to. And with that kind of stone, by cleaning it, taking the dirt off of it and with scented water and so forth, cleaning it, putting it on the top of a banner, on a pole high in the air, and making prayers, kind of like the Aladdin's lamp, it will bring about your wishes now. For instance, if you want to have companions, if you want to have wealth, if you want to have cattle, more Indian context, right? You may not want cattle where you are in Raleigh. If you want to have a Mercedes, whatever, you can, with a wish-fulfilling jewel, it will fulfill your present wishes. But that will not protect you. It can't give you a future rebirth as a human. It can only bring you, fulfill your worldly wishes of this lifetime. So that's what's being referred to here. So how are sentient beings superior to a wish-fulfilling jewel? Because by cherishing sentient beings, in the same way that you take care of the wish-fulfilling gem, you clean it, you treat it with respect, and so forth, by treating sentient beings with respect, cherishing them more than yourself, your wishes for the future can be fulfilled. You can be born as a human again in the future, as a god. You can create all of the karma necessary to develop peaceful mind, kindness, wisdom, and in so doing, also create the karma to become famous, to become wealthy, to have a beautiful body in the future, to have all of the conditions that the wish-fulfilling gem can give you now, sentient, by cherishing sentient beings. You can find all of those and more. You can, by cherishing sentient beings, you can even achieve enlightenment if you cherish them more than yourself. So the text says, Doncho Jupe Sampayi, the third line, with the Lama Zopa translations, determined to obtain the greatest possible benefit. And in English, he's put that as the first line. So you could say determined to achieve the highest welfare or the greatest benefit for sentient beings. What's the greatest benefit that you can achieve? It's said that, you know, that when we talk about the aim of self and others, the Buddhas have achieved their own aims and the aim of others. The aim of others is to be able to emanate the Nirmanakaya, the emanation body, like Buddha Shakyamuni, and to emanate the Sambhogakaya, the enjoyment body, which teaches the bodhisattvas, the Arya bodhisattvas. That's said to be the perfection of the aim of others, to be able to lead sentient beings in that way. The perfection of one's own aim is said to achieve the omniscient mind. Your own mind then is totally peaceful, never worried about the election like I am. So that we say that the Buddha has achieved his own aim, ultimate aim, the Dharmakaya, the wisdom body of the Buddha, and he has achieved the physical bodies of the Buddha, the Nirmanakaya and Sambhogakaya. So in order to achieve the greatest aim for sentient beings, that would mean to achieve enlightenment and the ability to emanate these bodies, for sentient beings who excel the wish-fulfilling gem, for the reason I mentioned, they excel the wish, they're greater or you know, more special, more perfect than the wish-fulfilling gem, because by depending upon sentient beings, you can achieve the welfare of future lifetimes and create the karma, even this lifetime, to be liked and loved, to heal yourself, but in the future to achieve all of the stages of the path to achieve enlightenment for their welfare. So I will hold them always. I will cherish them at all times. So the Tibetan word here, taktu means I will always or at all times hold them dear. This is another way of saying cherish them. So the word Lama Zopa translates as determined is the Tibetan word sampa, which can mean thinking. Or it can also mean Like when we develop bodhicitta, you know the stages of developing bodhicitta. There's one particular mind that comes just before bodhicitta called the exceptional resolve, laksam. Have you heard of that? Laksam? His Holiness the Dalai Lama over the years has begun to translate that as universal responsibility. It's kind of like a thought that greater than compassion, I myself must become Buddha in order to achieve the welfare of sentient beings. So that's how I take the word here, like responsible, to get the greatest, to achieve the greatest welfare for all sentient beings who themselves excel even the wish-fulfilling gem, I will hold them most dear. So the connection between the sentient beings excelling the wish-fulfilling gem and holding them dear or cherishing them is that in the same way, if you cherish the wish-fulfilling gem, it will fulfill your present needs. By cherishing sentient beings, oh, that's Adriana's daughter. By cherishing sentient beings, holding them more dear than yourself, you can achieve your own welfare and the welfare of sentient beings. So I like to experiment sometime. If you understand, if you've read some commentaries, you might like to change the wording a little bit to see, you know, without destroying the authenticity of the verses, to see what sort of is more fertile for your mind, what brings about, you know, some transformation of your mind. I've recited these eight verses. I might have missed one day or 2 days since 1974. But like Thubten Jinpa in his book, he mentions since he's received the teachings on this, he's recited every day. It's something that I say either right at the beginning of the morning or just before I say the mantras and visualization of Chenrezig, of Avalokiteshvara, the Buddha of Compassion. So you might find, if you haven't already done so, in receiving these, you know, this transmission, these talks about the eight verses, you might like to recite every day. And when you receive more teachings, if you again receive teachings on it, they will become richer. It's like the same way when the monks at the monastery, when they're young, they will first memorize the root text of some great treatise, you know, like the Abhidharma Kosha or the text on Abhidharma or the little verses that are almost impenetrable, you know, just a bunch of words together. When they receive commentary on that, memorizing the words is like building a stone wall, I think. There's something that you can call on. You can always go back and having memorized it, you can always call them to mind. Receiving the commentary is like putting the mortar between the stones or between the bricks. And by reciting the words, because of that, because of having received teachings on it, you also remember the meaning, the deeper meaning of that. And sometimes different meanings, you know, associated with it at different times. So I would recommend, if you have a chance to memorize these verses and say them every day, and when you do receive other teachings, you can look up on YouTube the Dalai Lama's teachings, or you can go to the Wisdom Archives, Lama Zopa Rinpoche's teachings, or Lama Yeshe's teachings on this that are written, I think, you know, that can maybe enhance your understanding of them. This is kind of like If this is the first time you're hearing about this, kind of like just wobbly putting the stones up there, and now you, with some explanation, you're putting a little bit of mud or mortar in between, and it has very great meaning. Okay? So, correct me if I'm wrong, Donna. This is we're meant to go to 8:30, right?
No, we can go to 9.
Oh, okay. Okay. So, so the way that I think of it is responsible, so the, instead of determined, with the responsibility to obtain the greatest welfare for all sentient beings who excel the wish-fulfilling gem, I will always cherish them. So this verse is talking about, I will always hold them dear. Lama Zopa adds the word most dear. The Tibetan doesn't have the word most in there, but that's how he's taking it, is I will cherish them. I will hold them most dear. That means more dear than yourself. Okay. Make some sense? Who's that? Someone moved their hand in front of the camera. Susan, that means yes, or that means no? Okay, I guess.
I'm sorry, I was checking chat, and I'm
using
a different format.
I wasn't sure whether you were saying yes or no. Okay. All right. So let me introduce the second verse, and we'll go back to these again in the coming days. And if you have any questions as we're going along, you know, about this, as you, if a question comes up later, you can again ask. So second verse says, Lama Zopa's translation, wherever I am and whoever I am with, what is it grammatically? Should be whomever I am with? Yeah. I always consider myself the lowest of all, and from the depths of my heart hold others dear and supreme. So now it adds this other word, supreme, not just or better than me. So here in various commentaries are different reasons that are given for this. Generally, these verses, after the first one, generally we're talking about setting up the idea of cherishing others more than oneself. And implicit in that, from the first verse, is also seeing the defects of cherishing myself, cherishing others all the time, holding them as dear. So now, in trying to practice in that way, when you meet various people, some of them can be problematic for that. So there are different situations. So this one is talking about the possibility of having developed this attitude. One of the big problems is dealing with people that you might feel superior to. Like, say, for instance, a person on the street who's begging. In India, it's very, very common, if you've gone to India. I suppose, I'm not sure in Raleigh, if you find, do you find people begging on the streets? Do you have the people that want to wash your windshield still, or is that the old days? No? Someone's saying yes, someone's saying no. So you might feel superior to people, and even, like, say, in giving to them, you might like toss some coins to them, or, you know, like treat them in a disrespectful way. So this is one of the greatest initial kinds of shortcomings to develop pride in your practice, so that you feel yourself superior to others. So this one is saying, wherever I am and whomever I am with, I I would say, I will always consider myself to be the lowest of all, and sincerely, another way of saying from the depths of my heart, hold others, cherish others as supreme. So this is not saying just cherish them. Lama Zubin says, hold others dear and supreme. The Tibetan doesn't say and, it actually says cherish them as supreme. Choktu Chepa Zimba Lap. So what that means is always to analyze when you deal with other people, if you're in a group of people, to see that even if your mind might initially think that they don't have as much education as you, they're not as wealthy as you, they don't come from the same high class. I don't know, you know, so, you know, maybe they, nowadays it's a very big prejudice against people, right? They're of a different class or of a different race or somehow inferior to you. Here, in whatever way you might consider yourself to be superior, to turn that around and to cherish others as supreme, that they have qualities that you may not recognize, but certainly they have been your mother in previous lifetimes. They have been your best friend numberless times. And to consider them as just like the way that we would consider our mom or our grandma when they're in a difficult situation, we would hold them as superior to ourselves. If a person comes on the bus, you have the nice seat. We consider it a noble person who would give up their own seat for the other, sort of considering that other person to be more important than themselves, supreme. Cherish others as supreme. Let me read you some other translations of this verse that some of the other authors have had. So this is from Geshe Sonam Rinchen's translation. Whenever I am in the company of others, so Rinpoche says, wherever I am and whomever I am with, so this word in the Tibetan, there's a word drok, which can mean in the company of, Rinpoche says with, Thupten Jinpa says, whenever I interact with others. Drokpa also can mean to help. So this verse can mean whenever I'm trying to help other sentient beings, whoever I'm trying to help, I will always consider myself to be, I will always hold them, cherish them as superior from the depth of my heart, sincerely, not just, you know, wagging your tongue, wagging your lip. I would consider myself to be the lowest, lower than them, and hold others as supreme. So Geshe Sonam Rinchen says, wherever I am, whenever I am in the company of others, may I regard myself as inferior to all, and from the depths of my heart, cherish others as supreme. So that's to me, that's more precise. Cherish them as supreme, not just hold others dear and supreme. There's the word and is not there. Thupten Jinpa's translation of that. Let's see, where is that? Do I have that here? Here we go. Whenever I interact with others, instead of whenever I'm with or whenever I help, whenever I interact with others, I will view myself as inferior to all and will train myself to hold others as superior from the depths of my heart. So he's left out the word dear. I will hold them. I will cherish them as superior. He just says, I will hold them as superior from the depth of my heart. And I'm going to read one other, just so you get an idea. You want to make sure that all of the main words are there. Whenever I am with others, this is the Geshe Sultan Gelten. Whenever I am with others, you know, there's an interact in the company of whatever. I will practice seeing myself as the lowest of all, and from the very depth of my heart, I will respectfully hold others as supreme. So that runs the gamut of the different translations of that. The one of the meanings of that is I mentioned in I taught the same text recently for the Seder in Washington, D.C. And was it there? Can't remember. I think I taught it there. So there's a saying in Tibet. Oh, no, I think I taught in, no, I taught in Singapore before Washington. I taught the 37 practices in Washington a couple of weeks ago. So there's an expression in Tibetan. In the springtime, the first grass grows, the first sprouts come in the bottom of the valley. And as the summer progresses, they start to grow along the sides of the mountains, where it's a little bit cooler, right? When the first thing grows at the lowest depths where it's warmer. But the grass never grows on the snowy peaks. Have you heard that verse before? I don't see anyone saying it. So the kind of gist of that is that realizations first will grow in a mind which is humble. It's almost as though having humility, holding yourself as lower, anything that others say almost becomes instruction to you. And so realizations grow more quickly in your mind. If you hold yourself as high and you're listening to Lama Zopa or someone and you say, oh, they made a grammatical mistake or they're slurring their words or oh, I know more than them or they're Tibetan and I'm this. You know. Very difficult for that, the blessings and understanding to enter your heart and for realization to grow. So just like the grass grows first in the lowest areas, and over time it may grow in on the sides of the hills. So if you have a little bit of pride, it takes longer for those realizations to grow, but it never grows on the snowy ice peaks of the mountains. So to the person who's very, very proud, although they may become adept in the words, philosophy, they become famous and so forth, debating, but it doesn't necessarily move their mind. So the whole point of practicing this is to try to bring about some transformation of your mind. That's why we call it thought transformation or training of the mind. Training of the thought, lo zhong. Lo can mean different things. Can mean intellect. It can mean attitude, like rong chenzingi lo, the self-cherishing. It's not called self-cherishing thought. It's called Lama Yeshe used to say it's kind of like an attitude. It's not an actual thought. So transforming your attitude. That's the whole purpose of this kind of practice, to bring about a transformation of yourself, to become a better person, to become more noble. So important words here. From the depth of your heart, sincerely, I will cherish others as supreme. So that may take some effort. You have to recognize, like in Atisha's jewel rosary of the bodhisattvas, he talks about even understanding, of course, understanding those who were superior to you as your teacher, understanding those who are your equal as your teacher, and even understanding those who you might think of as inferior to yourself as your teacher. You know, objectively speaking, they're poorer than you or whatever, they're not as educated or whatever, to recognize that they may have gems of insight that can transform your mind. Whoever I interact with, I will consider myself, Dakni Kunle Mentashing, I will view myself as inferior to all, and to hold, and I will cherish others as supreme. So the word cherish is still here. The first verse was talking about cherishing others as more important than yourself. Now it's cherishing them as superior to yourself in whatever way that your mind might have an obstacle to, you know, because of your pride. Does it make some sense?
Honorable George, we had a question.
Yeah.
Up in chat. The question is, why would anyone want any other goal than bodhicitta, like a solitary realizer? Is it that they have not been introduced, never heard of the Mahayana path?
That could be one of the reasons, but also the Buddha recognized that people have different imprints from previous lives. They have different aspirations and likings. So he did teach during his lifetime what was most famous, of course, was the obvious teachings to the hearers and solitary realizers, how to achieve nirvana when you talk about the Hinayana path, right? Or today's called the Theravada teachings. So the Buddha taught in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, the sutras, his discourses on the perfection of wisdom, he said, any of my disciples those of my disciples who are intelligent could investigate and should follow my Mahayana teachings. They should not be satisfied with my Hinayana teachings. So the Buddha actually used that word in his discourses, which, you know, sometimes in Asia, if you talk about Mahayana and Hinayana, the Theravada practitioners, like the Thai monks or the Malaysian monks or, you know, the Vietnamese monks that practice the Theravada, they think that is pejorative, like saying Mahayana is better, Hinayana is inferior, that we're better than you, right? So sometimes it's kind of, they call it, I think someone wrote, Dan Lopez or someone wrote a book called Not to Use the H Word, the Hinayana word. You know, like we talk about the different kinds of words you're not supposed to use, right? That are somehow pejorative. So, but the Buddha himself said that. He said that those who are intelligent shouldn't be satisfied with simply my teachings of the lesser vehicle. The Hinayana was a teaching system like a vehicle that gets you to a destination, right? We said the Hinayana. Hina means lesser or inferior. Yana means vehicle. I don't know, like cart or car or rocket or whatever. So he called his teachings to achieve nirvana his lesser vehicle, because it brought an individual to the lesser goal, not to full enlightenment, but just to nirvana. And it also is a small vehicle, you know, lesser vehicle, because it only brings yourself to that goal. Whereas his Mahayana, the great vehicle, takes you to the great destination of enlightenment and takes everyone along with you, because in achieving that, you will constantly work for them continuously in the future, effortlessly, spontaneously, perfectly, to bring sentient beings eventually to that same goal, to get them out of cyclic existence into full enlightenment. But the Buddha did know, you know, it's known that his obvious proclamation at the time, the main thing that was continued for such a long time that Western civilization first became aware of, was his Theravada teachings, the Hinayana teachings. That's what is renowned in the sutras, or as in the Pali language, you say suttas, that the Buddha taught in the Pali canon to how to achieve nirvana, how to get out of cyclic existence. And we ourselves have to train in that also. In the Prajnaparamita Sutras, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, it says the bodhisattvas should know the Hinayana path, should practice the Hinayana path, but not bring it to culmination. That means they shouldn't aim to achieve that liberation. They should train in it. They should know all of the teachings. Like in the Lanrim, that means the teachings of the person of initial scope and the person of intermediate scope. We have to train in those, but we're not training in them in order to achieve nirvana, but to recognize the shortcomings of cyclic existence so that we can develop even greater compassion for sentient beings. Even the rich and famous are suffering. You know, right now we might think, oh, the certain people are suffering, the people who are disenfranchised, you know, that don't have the same benefits, that are being discriminated from. William, you have a question?
Yes, okay. I have a question about this thing, because Hinayana or Mahayana both achieve nirvana or enlightenment. But once you help yourself, you help others. So I think it's very academic just to distinguish the two.
Oh, well,
if you achieve enlightenment,
Hinayana doesn't achieve enlightenment. Hinayana doesn't achieve enlightenment. The goal and the result of practicing the Hinayana path and actualizing it is to achieve nirvana. Nirvana is a state of mind where you have you've realized the non-existence of the self, the way that the mind grasps to it, which is the main progenitor of all of our delusions. Once you've realized selflessness, that's the main realization of the Hinayana path. And the motivation of the Hinayana path to realize that is to get out of samsara yourself.
But once you get out of samsara yourself, or once you enter any of this Buddhist path, you're helping yourself and you're helping others, because
indirectly, if you know, it's said in the Hinayana path, the arhats, they say, oh, by me not being around anymore in cyclic existence, I will no longer be an object of anger or attachment or jealousy of other sentient beings. So I benefit them indirectly. And during your life, as you're giving teachings, of course, you benefit sentient beings. But once you enter into that state, it's like being in a deep concentration on selflessness, for eons. And so you don't interact with other living beings during that time. The Buddha said that there is a higher goal than nirvana, the Hinayana goal of liberation, moksha or nirvana. And that is what's called bodhi, enlightenment, like the Buddha himself. Now, in the Hinayana teachings, one of their thoughts is that it's the rare individual, super, super rare, who achieves enlightenment, who becomes a bodhisattva and aims for enlightenment. In fact, they refer to the Buddha as the bodhisattva, meaning it's so rare, once every, you know, billion years, someone has this great aspiration to give up their own nirvana, to escape from samsara from oneself, and to continue taking rebirth again and again and again in cyclic existence, maybe for countless eons, for the welfare of others. Generally, that is the, from the Hinayana point of view, that's a super exceptional individual. Most people will just achieve nirvana. Okay? From the Mahayana point of view, even the individuals who achieve nirvana, once they've achieved that state, they're no longer out of their own karma and delusion. They're no longer born in cyclic existence. They will remain in that meditative state on selflessness for eons, but eventually they will be awakened by the force of the omniscient Buddhas, and they will be reminded that they haven't eliminated all of the faults of the mind. They've eliminated what's called self-grasping, the ignorance that mainly impels us into cyclic existence, but they haven't developed a special kind of compassion, what's called maha karuna, great compassion. They have a kind of great compassion because they feel, they understand the suffering of all sentient beings. They understand all the kinds of suffering, whether it be suffering of suffering, changeable suffering, all pervasive suffering. So in their tenets, they call that great compassion. But they don't have the Mahayana great compassion, which takes the responsibility that I myself, it's not just enough to feel compassion. Oh, poor things. You know, I wish they were out. Mahayana great compassion means taking the responsibility, which is what I called before, His Holiness calls the universal responsibility, to eliminate the suffering of all sentient beings and forego one's own achievement of nirvana, working, even if it takes eons, to achieve enlightenment, when and within that state, you yourself have greater qualities than a Hinayana arhat, the person who has achieved nirvana. You have a mind which is omniscient, that knows all phenomena of the past, present, and future. You know the minds of all sentient beings in detail. You know all the paths that can lead them out of their present state into higher states. There's even in the Buddha's the qualities of the bodhisattvas is called the knower of paths that lead everywhere. So they know how an individual in the hell realms can be led to, you know, to get higher and higher and then be born as a human and train them and so forth. Even if it takes eons, to be able to do that effortlessly without having to think about it, you know, how can I best, what's his name? I have to put my glasses on. How can I best help William? Maybe I can do this. One knows with omniscient mind exactly what, you know, how to manifest, how to teach, how to lead them out of that. So there's a big difference between the goal of the Hinayana and the goal of the Mahayana. In the Hinayana path, it generally is not recognized that the individual, the person who achieves nirvana, that kind of person is called an arhat, right? Have you heard that? Mm-hmm. Arhat. So it's generally not recognized that the arhat will be awakened after some time and be told that they have to re-enter cyclic existence and develop bodhicitta to achieve enlightenment. But that's the presentation of the Buddha's teachings in the Mahayana. So when the Buddha was alive 2,500 years ago, he generally taught what was most famous was the Hinayana path. But to certain individuals who were of higher intelligence, he taught the Bodhisattva path. And in some, he taught the Mahayana sutras. And some of those sutras, some of the Hinayana disciples were present. Not all of them, not the general disciples, but like the really cream of, what is it, the creme de la creme? Like Shariputra is there sometimes, and Mahamoggallana. They would listen, but they, you know, they, and they even ask questions, like in the Heart Sutra next weekend. Shariputra asks, who does he ask? Maitreya, I guess. You know, Chenrezig, the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. He asks the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara, how did the Bodhisattvas train in the perfection of wisdom? Because Shariputra, practitioner of the Hinayana, Buddha's disciple, one of his main two disciples, his main goal was to achieve nirvana, and he was considered to be the foremost in wisdom. You know, the Buddha would say, you know, Dana, you're the foremost in leading pujas, and Adriana, you're the foremost in flower arranging, or William, you're the foremost in whatever, you know. He would tell what their special qualities were, and Shariputra was known as the foremost of the Buddhist Hinayana disciples in wisdom. So when he heard about the perfection of wisdom of the Bodhisattva path, he asks Avalokiteshvara, who's a Bodhisattva, how did the Bodhisattvas practice their perfection of wisdom? Because he knew how the Hinayana practitioners practiced, but he didn't know how the Mahayana, the Bodhisattvas, practiced the perfection of wisdom.
Well, but and yet we benefit a lot from a lot of the Sariputra's teaching. And,
oh,
and
of course, we benefit a lot, but we don't benefit as much as if they had achieved enlightenment, and with that enlightened mind, omniscient mind, were omnipresent all the time, knew exactly when and how to nudge us, sometimes giving explicit teachings. Sometimes the omniscient mind appears as our neighbor, and the jacking up the car to fix the wheel, and the car falls on us, and just at the right time for us to develop compassion or something, you know, there's an immense difference. So, of course, the achievement, you know, remember Richard Nixon? I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember Richard Nixon. When Susie is real. So, when, and Barbara. So when Nixon left in disgrace, he was kind of kicked out. He resigned or something. He said, he told the reporters, now you don't have me to kick around anymore. Right? Now you don't have me to kick around. So it's kind of like that. The Hinayana, that's one of the things that they say, one of the benefits is that the Hinayana practitioner who achieves arhatship, nirvana, is not there in the world any longer as an irritant to other sentient beings. Because he's escaped into nirvana. He or she doesn't have the cherishing mind, the bodhicitta, that would impel them to take rebirth in cyclic existence again and again for the welfare of others. So it's not my interpretation. This is what the Buddha himself explained in the Mahayana Sutras. So if you just read the Theravada Sutras, In the Pali Canon, you won't encounter that thought because the Buddha taught, when he taught the Hinayana practitioners, he was teaching how to escape from samsara, because that's a big achievement. And indeed, you know, if people escape from that, they find, a freedom. They find real Dharma happiness, right? But they don't find, they will eventually be awakened from that, and they will eventually achieve enlightenment according to the Mahayana teachings. Okay.
Well, George, there's another question. If you want to go ahead, Barbara.
My question was, I don't understand how anyone that truly feels deep compassion and equity for others and actually endears them as a teacher, as everyone as a teacher and higher and more deserves great compassion, how anyone that reaches that and escapes samsara, is in a nirvana, how can they not feel compelled to come back to help others that are still in samsara?
So, no, from the start, a person who practices the the Theravada path, Hinayana path, what's called the Shravakayana or the Pratika Buddhayana, there's two varieties, one slightly sharper intellect than the other. Their main goal from the beginning, even from the teachings of the Buddha, is the Four Noble Truths. He said, when they first came to him in Deer Park, he came and he taught the five disciples who had meditated with him for, 6 years, you know, in ascetic practice.
Right.
He first said, this is suffering. He sort of pointed to his body, you know, meaning, you know, being a sentient being, he was referring to all compounded pervasive suffering, that simply still having within your continuum ignorance that grasps to inherent existence of oneself and other phenomena. This is an inferior state. This is not real happiness. Anything that you encounter now, you know, fame and fortune and beauty and wealth and so forth, it's not real happiness.
It's impermanent, very impermanent.
It's very impermanent. It's not satisfying, because it's not satisfying in the sense that no matter how much chocolate you eat, you'll never be satiated so that you never want chocolate again. You know, that's when we say, it's not satisfying. You might say, oh, it's satisfying. I was satisfied. I've had enough to eat. I don't want any more. But tomorrow you'll want more. And the day after that, in the next life, in the numberless lives in the future, while you're in samsara, you'll still want more. You want more love. You want more money. You want more fame. You want more possessions. You want more power. So the Buddha taught individuals who had that particular, even today, we see individuals, kind of hard to say politically, but almost you get the feeling that there's certain individuals who mainly want to have their own wealth, their own happiness, and the others who are not as well off, they can fend for themselves. Mm-hmm. Whereas there's another frame of mind, individuals who might think, oh, that's unjust, you know. Those who have so much wealth should give something back and help the others. And there's a big fight politically, you know, liberals and conservatives and this sort of thing. So I think it's reflected in that way. There are different states of aspiration that have been built up over numberless lives that put you into a certain predisposition to be attracted to the Hinayana path. And other individuals who have a predisposition to be attracted to the Mahayana path. Generally, when you enter into the Hinayana path, it means you've developed spontaneous renunciation of cyclic existence. You see it as faulty, you want to get out of it, and you've developed a strong motivation to achieve nirvana. Whereas in the Mahayana, the motivating factor is not renunciation alone, it's bodhicitta. I must achieve, you know, out of compassion for sentient beings, I must achieve enlightenment rather than nirvana to be able to bring about their welfare. So it's just 9 o'clock now. This is the time Donna said we should finish. So let's stop here. We're going to start again tomorrow at 1. Right, Donna? And let's do a little, just a short dedication. Sit comfortably like we did at the beginning. William's fired up. Relax your mind, relax your body. And recognize that this evening we've created, in listening to the teachings with a virtuous motivation, thinking about the teachings, maybe analyzing them, and having good questions, we've created some virtuous imprints in our mind that, left unattended, if not destroyed by anger or some other factor, will bring about some happiness within cyclic existence. Virtuous karma. So think, due to these merits, may, in whatever way they ripen, may they always be a cause of my continual spiritual evolution, spiritual development. Year by year, life by life, up to and including my achievement of enlightenment. Out of my concern, compassion for sentient beings. Due to these merits, may I quickly become a fully awakened, enlightened Buddha, from which state I can effortlessly and spontaneously, perfectly benefit all sentient beings. Due to these merits, you can dedicate the merits again and again. Due to these merits, may I quickly develop the precious mind of bodhicitta, which is not yet arisen, and that which, if I have some little inkling of it, may it not be lost, but grow even higher and higher due to these merits. So giving up any thought that the merits we've created are going to be, you know, mundane importance to us, bring some mundane happiness to ourselves, dedicating them to others. So thank you very much. See you tomorrow. If those of you who have the energy, a couple people dropped out, say there's 27. And Donna, if there are some questions that you get on the chat, if it's easy to put in an email, you can send me and I'll have them, you know, I'll think about questions, the answers to them. All right. So see you tomorrow.
Thank you, Venerable George. Wonderful night.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Venerable George.
Bye. Thank you so much.